This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Haydee Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Indeed, the issue of the funding is very critical at the moment because we already had a funding gap to respond to it.
And that was Claudio Giulia, an emergency specialist with UNICEF, talking about the need for aid money for Mozambique after Cyclone Kenneth. Also, negotiations are underway in Sudan to set up a joint civilian-military council. Libya was hit by heavy artillery and airstrikes overnight. And we take a look at next week's elections in South Africa. We'll have these stories and more for you, so do stay with us. There is lots more ahead here on Africa News Tonight. Top story at this hour, more than 150,000 people in northern Mozambique are struggling to recover from Tropical Cyclone Kenneth, which hit Cabo Delgado province Friday and Saturday. The storm has left tens of thousands homeless and heavy rains have cut many communities off from aid. At least 38 people have died since the storm. Claudio Giulia is an emergency specialist with UNICEF. He is working in Pemba, the Cabo Delgado provincial capital, coordinating recovery operations there for the United Nations Children's Agency. He tells VOA's Kate Pound Dawson that the storm has devastated the region and complicated efforts to recover from Cyclone Idai, which hit Mozambique's central coast last month.
Pemba and the whole province is currently under rain. It has been raining a lot since yesterday. Heavy rain. We have recorded heavy rainfall yesterday in Pemba and also at the coastal areas of the province. There are some areas that there is no access by road. So it is 5 districts. We cannot reach by road. We can only reach either by plane or by boat. At the moment, as per the government estimation, we have around 168,000 people affected in the whole province by the flood, by the cyclone and then the flood. The death toll confirmed as of today is 38 people. And the government also has, in terms of displacement, we have around 20,000 people that are currently displaced and accommodated in 30,000 centers. So in terms of the biggest challenge now is under logistics, so to get to access the areas that are not accessible by road.
At this point, is there any sign of disease outbreaks? We had cholera after Cyclone Idai. Is there any sign of anything like that?
Fortunately, we do not have any sign yet. But the health authorities, they are, as a prevention measure, they are already working on the activation of a DRL treatment center.
Now, how does the damage from Cyclone Kenneth compare with Cyclone Idai?
The damage of Idai was much bigger than Kenneth. The evidence of that is number of districts that were affected. So Kenneth only affected Cabo Delgado province, whereas Idai, for example, affected at least two big provinces, which is Sofala and Manila. Even in terms of number of people affected, Idai was bigger than Kenneth.
Is this new storm making it harder for the recovery efforts from Cyclone Idai?
Definitely, yes, because most of the supplies that we're bringing to respond to Kenneth are being moved from Beira, which we're already prepositioned to respond to the Idai situation. So, indeed, the issue of the funding is very critical at the moment because we already had a funding gap to respond to Idai, and now we have this also impact of Kenneth that is requesting our attention in terms of resources and funding.
And that was Claudio Gelaya with UNICEF in Pemba, Mozambique, speaking earlier with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson. Opposition leaders in Sudan are discussing who will sit on a joint civilian-military council expected to run the country for the next 2 years. Military leaders who ousted President Omar al-Bashir earlier this month agreed to the joint council on Saturday. Naba Mohideen has more from 4VOA from Khartoum.
Sudan's main protest group, the Sudanese Professional Association, held its third session Monday to decide who will get seats on the Joint Civilian-Military Council and what their role will be. The current Transitional Military Council, which has run the country since former President Bashir was toppled on April 11, agreed to share power with civilians after 2 weeks of protests in the capital of Khartoum and elsewhere. The TMC had originally said it would run the country for 2 years, ahead of planned election. Opposition groups rejected that and demanded a civilian-led council with executive authority. Despite the apparent progress, protesters like Huzaifa Hassan said they are still concerned. Hassan is against military leaders having executive power. Hassan said he doesn't see any point in giving military members executive authority. If this ends up with the military playing the role of making decisions, he says protesters wouldn't have revolted against the government in first place, or the first military council led by Defense Minister Ibn Auf and the members of the military council. However, another protester, Sheikh Haddin Abdullah, thinks a military role in the council is a good idea. He says the formation of a military-civilian council is satisfying due to conflicts between parties, armed opposition and many internal issues that resulted from 30 years of inequity and exclusion. That will not end with a completely sovereign civilian council. He says it needs a military council too. Meanwhile, a sit-in outside army headquarters that began more than 3 weeks ago continues. The protesters who originally gathered to demand the removal of Bashir's 30-year iron-fisted rule have said they will not leave until the military hands over power to civilians. TMC head Lieutenant General Abdel Fattah Burhan has promised to hand over power to civilians soon. Naba Mohideen for VOA News, Khartoum.
Well, as talks between Sudan's protesters and the military make slow progress on the issue of civilian rule, one group is creating a colorful push to the process. A group of protesters, protester artists, is painting a 3-kilometer-long banner that tells the story of Sudan's ongoing revolution. Ruud Elmendorp reports from Khartoum.
We're in a courtyard, 100 meters away from a demonstration in Khartoum. Dozens of artists here are kneeling above a white textile canvas. They're painting images of weapons, soldiers, and artistic interpretations of the Sudanese national flag. And some just paint what they feel at that moment. The 40-year-old artist Mohammed Ashraf, dressed in a yellow and blue polo shirt, is one of the artists. Ashraf has been here in central Khartoum since December, protesting with thousands of Sudanese over fuel and food shortages and a political situation.
Just to fall down. Just to fall down.
Protesters drove the military to oust President Omar al-Bashir after 3 decades in power and are now pushing for civilian rule. Ashraf and his fellow artists are creating a 3-kilometer-long textile banner to spread that message.
To give us the confidence that place it's peaceful, it's like a soft talk about freedom. And, you know, it's an entertainment to us, for example, and to impress our vision and our thought.
Thousands of artists have worked on the banner, which tells the story of Sudan's present-day revolution and past oppression. They plan to finish within weeks. And if there's still no civilian rule, raise it at a central protest outside military headquarters. Sudan has seen popular revolts for democracy in the past that the military put down. Ashraf, however, believes that this time there will be real change.
After 30 years, with one government, any change, it's change. But it's hard, last period is very hard to us. And we, this little bit of freedom that what we have now, it gives us power to go through and forward to the real freedom, inshallah.
It's getting dark during the demonstration here in Khartoum. New groups of demonstrators still flock in with banners and drums. They're asking for civilian rule. Hundreds of demonstrators wave with the flashlights on their mobile phone, as if to say they are hoping for daylight after three decades of darkness. Ruth Elmendorp for VOA News, Khartoum.
Airstrikes have pounded several areas around the Libyan capital as the United Nations warns that conditions for civilians are likely to decline further. The assault to Take Tripoli by Field Marshal Khalifa Haftar's self-styled Libyan National Army began on April 4th and has killed about 280 people and injured more than 1,300. The fighting has largely been bogged down in the suburbs, and these tolls are likely to jump as artillery and airstrikes have hit civilian areas and blocked roads, trapped many people, with 41,000 already fleeing. Pope Francis wants so-called humanitarian corridors to be opened to evacuate those who want to leave. The damage extends beyond the injured. UN officials say more than 1 million school books were destroyed when a Ministry of Education warehouse was hit. Elsewhere on the continent, when Cyril Ramaphosa became president of South Africa just over a year ago, relief swept the country. The hero of the struggle against apartheid turned super-rich businessman was embraced almost as if he were a messiah. Many voters were tired of a decade of President Jacob Zuma's government, years of corruption, scandals and political chaos. Millions of South Africans are unemployed, health services are collapsing, and these realities mean that the nation's love affair with Ramaphosa has since cooled. In Johannesburg, Darren Taylor evaluates the president's performance and the challenges he faces ahead of the country's election on May 8th.
I want to be there when the people start to turn it around. I want to be there for the alcoholic. I want to be there for the victims of violence. I want to lend a hand. Send me.
President Ramaphosa quotes legendary South African musician Hugh Masekela and gets a standing ovation in Parliament a few months after taking office. A year later, Ramaphosa is less popular, but many political analysts and public opinion polls still expect him to win next month's election. Surveys show his ANC party likely to capture 57% or more of the vote. University of Johannesburg Vice Chancellor Adam Habib thinks the president has proven his pedigree since replacing Zuma.
Under the conditions we are in, he is the best case scenario. He broadly believes in crafting a non-racial South Africa, and he's committed to inclusion in some form. I think that that's enough to work with.
Political analyst Melanie Verwoerd is a former member of parliament from Ramaphosa's ANC party. She says one thing in his favour is that the main opposition Democratic Alliance has been too inept to take advantage of the ANC's weaknesses.
Ramaphosa is the only game in town for South Africa at the moment.
The director of South Africa's Institute for the Study of Democracy, Professor Stephen Friedman, says the new president has made positive moves against corruption.
Putting in place a commission of inquiry which is investigating these issues, a new head of the Public Prosecution Service who is widely regarded as independent and very competent.
But evidence before the very commission has linked him to a firm called Busasa that allegedly bribed top ANC officials to win contracts. There's no suggestion that Ramaphosa himself received a kickback. Nevertheless, a large donation from Busasa to his ANC presidential campaign and payments of millions of rands to his son from the company cast a shadow over the president. Habib says Ramaphosa must produce strong evidence to exonerate himself and must target the ringleaders of the corruption that flourished under Zuma. The analysts agree that if there's one issue that Ramaphosa has played badly so far, it's land. They say his insistence that the ANC-led government will expropriate land, including white-owned farms, is costing South Africa millions of dollars in investment. Vurvurt says Ramaphosa cannot be expected to win every battle within his party.
At times he's been forced to take certain policy lines, which I don't think he's necessarily comfortable. So, for example, the whole issue around the expropriation of land without compensation, I don't think that's something he ideally would have wanted, but it was something that came from the ANC's conference at Nasrec.
Still, Friedman says, as with most elections everywhere, this one is fundamentally about the economy, specifically jobs for the 10 million unemployed.
Unless we begin to do on the economic front as a society what we did on the political front 25 years ago, and that is to begin to negotiate changes in the economy which would open it up to more people, then a lot of the problems will persist.
The analysts say growing inequality is South Africa's biggest challenge. The longer it festers, some say, the greater the chance for social polarization that could result in widespread violence. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
And you're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington. And at 22 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Aid workers are trying to reach parts of Mozambique that have been cut off by Cyclone Kenneth. Negotiations are underway in Sudan to help set up a joint civilian-military council. And Libya's been hit by heavy artillery and airstrikes overnight. For more news and information, do visit our website at voaafrica.com. Zimbabwe ranks among the most corrupt countries in the world. That's according to global watchdog Transparency International in its 2018 report. President Emmerson Mnangagwa agrees with the characterization of Zimbabwe as a country in which corruption has reached alarming levels. Eddie Gondo gives us more on the story.
Speaking in a televised interview aired by the Zimbabwe Broadcasting Corporation, ZBC, on the eve of the country's Independence Day celebrations on 18 April, the Zimbabwean president admitted that his anti-corruption fight has not gained much traction. Zimbabwe stands at 160 out of 175, alongside countries such as Angola, which is at 165, and Somalia being the most corrupt at 180, according to the Corruption Perception Index by Transparency International. Observers say that the government lacks the will to eradicate corruption within its own ranks, a point which Mnangagwa raised in his pre-independence address as he fingered the police and the judiciary within the country. Dr. Raymosi, a clergyman and civic society leader, sees the corruption in Zimbabwe as being triggered by and enshrined within the ruling party's culture.
Impunity and entitlement has been the major contributing factor to the corruption in Zimbabwe. Therefore, you will find that whether you are at the top within the army, at the top within the military, at the top within the CIOs, at the top within ZANU-PF, it means you are entitled to get whatever you want, and you can demand it from anybody, and through that, you can also be protected by the powers that be.
Despite assuming power on a new dispensation ticket and having named and shamed a list of individuals and business entities that it allegedly externalized over US 800 million, highly placed persons with ties to the Mnangagwa regime were not included in the list. Observers say that Mnangagwa lacks the will to crack the whip on members of the ruling party, who are widely regarded to have amassed riches using embedded political connections and loyalties. For civic society leaders, such as Monsi, the responsibility for dealing with corruption lies in the executive branch of government.
Because you cannot be protected until we begin to see clear proof that the powers that be, particularly the president, is dealing with the people that are corrupt and corruption that is prevailing in our country. This scenario will continue to be perpetuated and to be sustained.
While concurring with Morsi that the executive needs to lead in anti-graft efforts, other observers such as Rod Dwe see a need to adopt controversial measures to curb corruption.
We also have to acknowledge that corruption does not only run in government, it's also there in the private sector. And in actual fact, the most painful part about corruption in this country is that it has become a way of life. Go walk in any street, find someone who's doing bad, he will just tell you simple, you know what, the police comes here, I'll give him something, he will go away. The authority comes here, I'll give them something, go away. I think we need to deal with corruption from that end, from a person, the man in the mirror. It starts from there. But government must lead by example. I think we need also to look at drastical action, consider drastical actions like killing.
According to Transparency International, cross-analysis with global democracy data reveals a link between corruption and the health of democracies. It reveals that the continued failure of most countries to significantly control corruption is contributing to a crisis in democracy around the world. Four democracies score an average of 75 on the CPI Corruption Perception Index, whilst flawed democracies score an average of 49, with autocratic regimes performing worst of all, with an average score of just 30 on the Corruption Perception Index. The Corruption Perceptions Index is an index published annually by Transparency International since 1995, and it ranks countries by their perceived levels of public sector corruption, as determined by expert assessments and opinion surveys. Rwanda and Namibia are among the highest ranking sub-Saharan African countries at 48 and 52 respectively. Zimbabwe's neighbors South Africa and Zambia sit at 73 and 105 respectively. Observers say that the Zimbabwe government has a lot of groundwork to do before the world fully embraces its open for business mantra. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Haley Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports that's coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thank you for choosing The Voice of America.
This is James Butty, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05 and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. That's Daybreak Africa right here on VOA Africa.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.